Descendants made me feel real, much more than the VR could. Knowing that a piece of me had lived on was satisfying on a level that I couldn't come up with words to describe. It might not be quite like being a parent or grandparent, but it would certainly do as a next best. I popped up an inset list. System tests, integration tests, stress tests, and finally a shakedown cruise. Stuff happens, of course, but it should be pretty routine.
And the third ship?
Naturally, Julia was interested in that one. She and her family would all be on Exodus 3 along with the Spitz group. I had wrung that promise from Cranston before agreeing to his proposal. There was no reason for him to renege. The 300 or so people who couldn't fit on the third ship would be the first onto the fourth, and were guaranteed established homes when they arrived in Omicron Squared Eridani. Cranston had asked for volunteers, and surprisingly, he'd gotten them. I guess some people are happy to skip the hard work part. Julia sighed and smiled at me.
Before you arrived, there was a general feeling that we might be the last generation of humanity. Some people were saying it was selfish to have more children. I'm glad it didn't turn out that way.
She hugged her son, Justin, one of the newest members of Clan Bob, sitting on her lap. Justin had no idea what was going on, but the pictures were pretty, and he loved his Uncle William. I made a face at him and he laughed. Justin Hendricks, Space Cadet. 55. Bob, July 2166, Delta Eridani. The day finally arrived when we reached the area of the Flint site. The former camp was at the top of a rise that stuck up out of the general forest level. On Earth, a castle would have been built there. From my earlier survey, I knew that it commanded a view of the forest for miles in every direction, right out to mountains and hills on the horizon. The site was rocky and bare, but had a depression at the base of a rock shelf that formed a natural, sheltered area. Several rock pools formed natural reservoirs filled by the frequent rains. A central mesa rose from the shelf like the conning tower of a submarine. It was, in fact, such a naturally ideal site that conversations kept coming around to why it had been abandoned.
"Don't know,"
was all we got from most of the elders. Moses commented that he only remembered his parents being very scared. He thought, and it seemed likely, that the place had been overrun by gorilloids. One of the other elders, I noticed, didn't seem comfortable with that explanation. I resolved to talk to him later. I directed the drones to do a quick survey to a mile in radius looking for gorilloids. The results were chilling. This appeared to be a gorilloid preserve or something. The damn things were everywhere, but why? With no Deltans to eat, this felt like a badly laid out D&D scenario. The answer wasn't long in coming. I hadn't really done much in the way of biological analysis or investigation since I'd discovered the Deltans, and I guess this was my comeuppance for that oversight. The gorilloids were omnivores. The vegetation on this side included a tree with nutritious seed pods, the gorilloids' primary staple. The pods were tough to get to and tough to open, which explained the size and strength of the animals. And if the biochemistry of Eden followed that of Earth, the pods would be incomplete protein sources. So what has lots of protein? Deltans, of course. That looked like the explanation. The seed pods were more than plentiful enough to supply a large population of gorilloids, but the beasts would be crazy attracted to protein sources. And I'd just marched a couple of hundred bundles of protein right into the middle of them. Great. But there was still something about the gorilloid population that didn't add up. Without warning, a couple of loud booms reverberated through the forest.
"Two gorilloids approached within proscribed distance and were neutralized."
"Thanks, Guppy. Good job." I didn't want any surprises, so I'd instructed Guppy to busterize any gorilla that strayed within 100 meters of the Deltans. The Deltans were quite used to the sonic booms now and only looked up to check for more gorilloids, but drone sensors showed gorilloids leaving the area in a hurry. "Arnold, we need to get into a defensible position." Arnold nodded to the drone, then turned and started yelling orders. Deltans moved with alacrity toward the bluff. Outriders on guard brandished the biggest and best spears. The Deltans settled in without difficulty. There were old fire pits, cleared off sleeping areas, and even piled up rocks usable for building small walls. Arnold set up sentries immediately and asked me about the distribution of local gorilloids. He didn't look like he liked my answer. Couldn't really blame him. The moment their luggage hit the ground, Archimedes and Moses headed off for an area that Moses pointed to. The Acme Axe and Spearhead Manufacturing Company, unincorporated, was about to be launched. I assigned a drone and a couple of busters to shadow them. "Well, are we going to do a culling?" Marvin's expression indicated pretty clearly what he thought of the idea. "No, you're right. We need a long-term solution which involves gorilloids learning to avoid this area, and teaching their young to avoid it as well. I'll keep the buster AMIs on sentry duty, and we'll just take out any gorilloid that comes too close. They'll eventually make the connection.
And the tribe will learn to expect the protection of the Bob."
Marvin laughed, but I sensed an edge to his humor. I directed a raised eyebrow his way.
"Have a look, boss man," he said,
and pulled up video output from one of the drones. In a corner of the flint site, some Deltans had carefully arranged pieces of a buster and had placed small torches around them. My eyes widened.
"That's an altar." "Yep. All hail the Bob."
56. Bill, March 2167, Epsilon Eridani. The orbital schematic display laid it all out, and I didn't like the message. I looked over at Guppy. No help there. Admiral Akbar stared back at me, blank, fishy expression revealing nothing. "Can we still save the iceberg?"
"Probability greater than 50%. However, we may not be able to save the asteroid moving equipment."
I rubbed my forehead and tried not to swear. "Okay, Guppy, you take care of the course corrections. I'll set up a script for the drones for retrieval of the drive. Maybe we can cut some corners." The iceberg coming up on Ragnarok was one of the biggest we'd found so far in the Kuiper Belt. This particular piece of ice had come in a little off course, and we were going to have to run the asteroid drive at maximum until the very last moment to get it into the proper trajectory. I didn't want to fumble it and have the berg sail off into the sun, or worse, impact the planet at speed. Guppy began applying course corrections, with the changes registering on the schematic in real time. I watched the display absently while I weighed my options. If necessary, I was prepared to let the drive go down with the iceberg and just build a new one. For a smaller chunk of ice, I'd have just shrugged and let it sail on past the planet, but this baby was huge. I could lose every other incoming chunk for the next 6 months while I built a new drive and still come out ahead. But if I lost the drive, I'd have no control over the pieces following this one. If one came in dead center, I would have to watch it go splat. We were shepherding chunks of ice from the Kuiper Belt, spaced about a week apart. Garfield found them and sent them inwards using his asteroid moving drive, and I caught them at this end with mine. In another 10 years, we would have dropped enough ice on Ragnarok to connect its small seas into actual oceans. My long-term plan was to make the planet fit for humanity to colonize.
"Coming up on alignment. 2 minutes to shutdown."
"Thanks, Guppy. How much time will I have to get the drive off the berg?"
650 seconds.
Wow, that was tight. I reviewed the script that I'd written for the drones. 12 minutes required for a clean retrieval. That was with some wiggle room, but still. There were 12 separate structures that had to be released from their anchors and flown off the interplanetary iceberg before it hit atmosphere. I had already written off the anchors. They would take far too long to extract. Hopefully they wouldn't do too much damage when they hit the ground. Garfield popped into my VR. "How's it looking, Bill?" He was watching the whole drama unfold and thankfully hadn't tried kibitzing. There wasn't anything he could do anyway from his location in the outer system. Twice the number of drones wouldn't have been enough to save all the equipment. I grinned at him. "Just another day at the office. Nothing to see here. Move along."
"Shut down. Begin retrieval."
I ordered the drones to start the retrieval process. From here on, it was up to the AMI artificial intelligences controlling the drones. All I could do was stay out of their way and not joggle their elbows. Either they'd save the equipment or Ragnarok would have some new craters. 650 seconds later, the ice asteroid hit atmosphere. We were out of time. If the Berg was left to itself, it would skip through the upper atmosphere and sail on into the sunset, quite literally. Instead, I activated a number of explosive devices, and the iceberg fractured into a huge number of chunks, small enough to be melted before they made it through the layer of atmosphere. As the air dragged at them, they separated into diverging trajectories. They would all melt at high altitude and fall to the ground as rain over the next several days to weeks. Except for a bunch of anchors and two drive segments, which would suffer a slightly different fate. Nuts. I looked at Garfield and shrugged.
Well, I did warn you that could happen. Far be it for me to say I told you so.
No, of course not. I grimaced at the video. The next chunk of ice is due in a week. It's going to go splat, I'm afraid. Nothing we can do about that one. But if you can fly a couple of segments here ASAP, I can catch the ones after that.
And then build some spares?
Short term, yes. Longer term, Garfield, the whole anchoring thing bugs me. Slows down the installation, slows down the removal. Something was bound to go wrong eventually. I've been thinking of ways to do this without actual ground contact.
Garfield looked surprised. Seriously? Like, just position the segments in orbit around the ice chunk?
Mm-hmm. It would require two separate drive channels, but there's nothing wrong in principle with the idea. It would speed things up a lot. And I need a break from the Android project. Working the bugs out of that thing has become a game of whack-a-mole.
Garfield laughed. Okay, old man. I'll pull a couple of segments and head them your way.
Despite my comment to Garfield, as soon as I had parked the surviving drive segments, I opened up my Android project file. A video window opened up showing my current prototype located over on one of the orbiting labs. The Android was currently powered down and draped on the support rack. Bullwinkle was a quadruped design about the size of a moose and every bit as pretty. The external comms array on its head was strangely reminiscent of a famous pair of antlers. Probably not coincidence. Did I mention I'm not very mature? This was Bullwinkle version 5 kajillion or something. The basic concepts weren't that difficult. Artificial skeleton made from carbon fiber matrix, muscles made from memory plastics that would contract when a current was applied, and sensors to replicate the normal 5 senses. Package the whole thing up with a remote control system and a replicant, like yours truly, should be able to control it as if it was my own body. Well, that was the theory. Getting it working was an ongoing exercise in frustration. Bullwinkle was working fine, mechanically. The problem was with senses, reflexes, and communications. Wiring for touch, heat, and cold sensitivity required micro-precision akin to neurosurgery. Printers could only help so much, and the more of the contextual processing I built into Bullwinkle, the bigger the required local computer system. The more of it I designed to be handled remotely, the greater the required bandwidth, and the more that light-speed latency screwed things up. FTL communications would alleviate that, but I was still nowhere near making a scut small enough to fit into the moose. I ultimately wanted controlling the android to be an immersive experience. I wanted to feel myself running across the ground. I wanted to feel heat and cold and touch and the wind on my face. This was a far cry from controlling a drone or Buster, which was more like playing a video game. I was 90% there, but the last 10% was turning out to be a real PITA. With a sigh, I closed the folder and reopened the Asteroid Mover project. Back to work. 57. Mario, August 2169, Beta Hydri. Beta Hydri was 23.4 light years from Sol. Rather than argue and compete with the other new Bobs for the closer candidate stars, I had decided to head for the far reaches. I loved to sail forbidden seas and all that Melvillish stuff. By the time everyone else worked their way out to this point, I hoped to have a working space station declaring Mario was here. And let's face it, I really didn't want to be around the other Bobs. It still amazed me how oblivious they were to the differences between each clone. It was creepy, not enough variation to make them separate people, but enough to give them different opinions. It was like seeing myself with brain damage. And yeah, Bob wanted to set the rule about Senior Bob being in charge, but I didn't see that holding for long. Original Bob had never been much of a follower. Well, whatever. I was here, they were there, and I liked it that way. Time to explore my domain. I dropped into the system, decelerating at a leisurely 2G. I could have come in a lot hotter, but on the off chance that there was a Medeiros here, I didn't want him to know what I had under my hood. He'd see the 2G, a fraction of the output of my heavily shielded reactor, and he'd get cocky, I hoped. I really wanted a chance to meet up and hand him another ass-whooping. I had a couple of busters with his name on them. No, really, there wasn't a lot to do between systems, so I'd had the roamers stencil his name on a couple of busters. So far, though, there didn't seem to be anything Brazilian in the neighborhood. Actually, there didn't seem to be much of anything. It was a large, well-filled-out system, but so far, I'd found no metal ore. Seriously, nothing! This star's spectral lines showed about two-thirds Sol's metallicity. Generally, the composition of the system would follow the composition of the parent star. Hands behind my back, I walked around the balcony of my treehouse, enjoying the view and the thousand-meter drop to the forest floor. The forest had never existed except in literature, and even there it was an amalgam of a lot of different books. Mostly it was from Foster's Midworld, but I'd thinned things out so there were good lines of sight. I'd added lots of earth birds and deleted any large, hungry, dragony things. I raised an eyebrow at Guppy. Got an opinion?
Above my pay grade.
I chuckled. The version 2 heavens had more core and memory space than Bob 1 had started out with. Guppy had a lot of room to expand in the standard design, and I'd given him even more. He was becoming a person in his own right. He was acerbic and flip, just this side of insolent. I loved it. And, of course, he wasn't a Bob clone. Okay, wise guy, got an analysis?
Those I have. Analysis? There's no metal.
Thank you, Captain Obvious. Any idea why?
No, but I note that all of the other elements are within expected ratios. Only metals are missing, and completely so.
And that was just not possible, not by any known theory of stellar or planetary formation. Guppy blinked once and turned to face me. I knew what was coming.
Someone else was here first.
Damn it! Medeiros. But shouldn't there still be an auto factory around? I cut off what I was about to say and thought for a few seconds. Something was fishy with that theory, beside the originator. Hold on. How much ore are we talking about? Based on how much we think this system should have, how long would it take Medeiros to turn it all into cute little Medeiri? Guppy thought for a moment, or calculated, or whatever.
1,732 years, give or take.
So we can rule that out. We've only come 20-odd light years, and he would have had to travel for the same amount of time. I was belaboring the obvious, and I knew it, but I'd always found that talking something out helped to work through it in my mind.
That does represent a flaw in the theory.
You think? I pointed to the inner planets on the system schematic. We may end up having to do some planetary mining. Let's go take a look at some of the rocky planets and see what's available.
Your wish is my command.
We took a few days to get to the fourth planet. I still didn't want to show all my cards in case someone was watching. GL-19-4 was a brown ball of mud with gray oceans and a thick, murky atmosphere. It looked like the result of a lot of volcanic activity, but I didn't see any immediate candidates in the way of rings or chains of volcanoes. I inserted myself into a polar orbit and began deep scans for, well, anything, really. Metal deposits, of course, but also volcanic activity, and anything else interesting. It was one of those good news, bad news situations. Good news? I found lots that was interesting. Bad news? No metals. None. Not within reach of anything in my arsenal, anyway.
The planet had a magnetic field, so it obviously had a metallic core, but next to nothing in the crust. Oh, a patch here and a patch there, but not worth grubbing for.
Anomaly detected.
And this isn't anomalous enough already?
Double plus anomaly detected. Better?
Not loving it quite so much. For a fleeting moment, I thought of reinitializing Guppy. Only for a moment. Not that I needed to worry. One of our redesign items was to not allow Guppy to read our thoughts. That was just too creepy. He now required voice commands, however you define voice in a computer system that talks to itself. Okay, Guppy, what is it?
Accumulation of refined metal detected. An artifact.
Holy crap, I thought for a moment. Deploy three of our exploration drones. Send them down to the location of the anomaly. Have them carry a couple of roamers, too. Set one of the drones to spiral outward from the site, while the other two and the roamers investigate the site in detail.
Aye.
Guppy was all business now. This was serious. Had Medeiros crashed? Was it a probe from one of the other nations? The drones got there in record time. I think Guppy might have driven them a little aggressively and settled around the anomaly. One started to circle, gradually getting farther from the center while the other two landed and spit out 20-centimeter roamers. The drones lifted off and started on close-up visual scans. One thing was obvious right away. This wasn't one of the probes. In fact, this wasn't from Earth at all. I couldn't describe exactly what about it screamed alien, but no human mind designed that. The best metaphor I could come up with was the alien ship in Prometheus. It just didn't make sense. I took a moment to savor the thought. I had just found the first intelligent life outside of Earth. Well, okay, looking at the wreck, I might have just found the corpses of the first intelligent life, but still. It was obvious that this had been some kind of cargo carrier. The thing had crashed and split open. It had spilled out part of its contents, which seemed to consist of stacks and stacks of large metal ingots of various types. Each ingot was pure, all one element. Iron, titanium, copper, nickel, tons of the stuff. The carrier looked like it had only been a quarter full, though, unless some had been taken. It appeared we had found our metal thieves. Well, one of them. And thief was probably too strong a word, but still.
Anomaly.
Oh, for what now?
See for yourself.
I picked up the video that Guppy offered to me, and my jaw dropped. The planet wasn't lifeless. Well, it was now, but it hadn't been at some point in the past. I was looking at a dead ecosystem. What you'd get if everything in the Amazon basin died all at once. It was dry, it was weathered, it was corroded. But it was trees and bushes and the occasional animal, and it went on forever. I sent down some biological analysis drones to do some necropsies and try to figure out what had happened here. That wasn't quite what they were designed for, but I had all the accumulated biological and medical knowledge from Earth and a very advanced piece of technology designed by, me. They poked and prodded and cut, and they got some suitable specimens. They had their orders, and the AMIs were entirely competent within the parameters they'd been assigned. I just had to stay out of the way and not joggle their mechanical elbows. The drones and roamers continued to examine the wreckage. Without being able to say why, I sent a couple of busters down to hover, menacingly. Things looked deader than dead, but I just had a spooky feeling. The report from the biological drones arrived on my desktop with a ding. I hurried over and opened the file. Oh, wow. Based on cellular damage, everything had been killed by something along the lines of a gamma ray burst. Basically a huge surge of radiation, more than enough to kill instantly. I knew that because not only had the animals been killed, but their intestinal flora, or the local equivalent, had been killed at the same time. There was no bloating, no rotting from the inside out. I had to make some assumptions using terrestrial analogies, but I was pretty confident that they would be close enough. I also noted how few carcasses we'd found. The specimens were all small, in odd, inconvenient places, or in poor condition, even for dead bodies. I was pretty sure that 99% of the fauna were unaccounted for. Without decomposition to provide a clue, I couldn't immediately tell how long ago this had happened, but wear and erosion on the carcasses and dead trees gave me some indications, as did an analysis of the number of forest fire tracks with no new growth. I estimated somewhere between 50 and 100 years ago. I sent the biological drones off to check another couple of points on the planet, especially a point as close to antipodal to this location as possible.
Emergency! Hostile activity!
What? What's happening?
One of the roamers is under attack.
Get the drones to do point-focused sudar pings. I want as much detail as you can get.
Done.
I dissolved my VR and cranked up to maximum frame rate. The video feed was real-time. It showed a window from the perspective of the roamer that was under attack, and another from the perspective of the second roamer. The first roamer seemed to be infested with mechanical ants. As I watched, the roamer was being eaten. Metal parts thinning and dissolving. Guppy, blow both roamers. Self-destructs now. Guppy didn't argue or question. The video feeds disappeared. And firewall our device comms. I doubt those things had time to finagle the encryption keys from the roamers, but why take chances? I turned to the sudar analysis, which was just assembling over the desk. To one side, Guppy had brought up the video record received from the roamers. I played back the video record first. The first roamer had opened a container or locker or something. It appeared to have activated the ants. Whether that was a defensive reaction or the ants just considered the roamer to be a resource to be acquired was anyone's guess. I doubted there was really much practical difference. Either way, the ants had started to disassemble the roamer. The sudar point scan showed that they were separating it by element. They didn't seem interested in the plastic and ceramic components. I didn't regret blowing up the roamers. I certainly couldn't have brought them back with the possibility of one of those ants coming along for the ride, and silly as it was, I'd read and seen enough science fiction in my day about advanced technologies taking over the communication system and getting into the computer. That's me we're talking about, after all. I can build more roamers. Where did the ants get their power from? I scanned the ship again and found that about half of the ants that had survived the roamer suicides were now still. I didn't know if they were dead or just on standby. I decided to scan at 5-second intervals to see what they were up to. Strangely, every time I scanned, more ants became active. The hell? I cut off the sudar scans for a full minute. When I did another scan, about a quarter of the ants were inactive. Oh, hell. I stopped scanning for 5 minutes, then did a quick scan with as low power as I could manage. Sure enough, most of the ants were inactive. Damn it, they're powered by the sudar beam. It was my scans that reactivated them. Well, that was a fine pickle. Any attempt to find out what they were doing would power them up. But that meant that the aliens had found some way to beam power through subspace and use it at the receiving end. I needed to examine those ants. I waited an hour, then sent a single 1-centimeter roamer in. No way an ant could piggyback undetected on a roamer only slightly bigger than itself. The roamer picked up a couple of ants and brought them out of the hulk. I had prepared a couple of small coffins for the ants, filled with a plastic goop. The roamer stuffed the ants into the goop, then added the hardener. I now had ants under glass, more or less. While they might be able to cut their way out of those, I hoped they couldn't do it before I completed a scan. I brought in my two drones in close, and they did the most intense and high-precision close-in scans of which they were capable. That would produce almost a molecular-level map of the ants. I watched in fascination as the ants both powered up and produced little cutters from their front appendages. Fortunately, they couldn't move, so all they did was drill a couple of holes in the plastic. Good to know. I detonated the roamer, can't be too careful, and retired to my treehouse to ruminate. I had completed my survey. There was no sign of a civilization on this planet, so the wreck was definitely alien. The aliens had come in, presumably killed all life with some kind of radiation weapon, mined the star system, collected the carcasses, then left. There were a lot of assumptions in there, but it fit the evidence. The scan of the ants had shown some interesting technology. I was already setting up simulations to test some of it. The scans of the Hulk didn't have any huge surprises. It appeared to be run by an AI or AMI of some kind. It had a fusion reactor. It had a surge drive. It had a Sudar transmitter. However, the Sudar unit seemed designed to transmit power to a tuned receiver, as well as using the Sudar as radar. I'd taken detailed scans of that for further study. Maybe the aliens had come and rescued the crew and left the Hulk. I doubted that. There didn't really seem to be any accommodation for anything biological. It was probable that the ship was completely AI. Was this civilization biological at all? The fact that they'd collected all the carcasses hinted at an answer, and not one that I liked at all. I could only think of one reason to bother collecting all that protein. And was this a one-time event? Or were they raiding systems on an ongoing basis? If so, which way were they heading? I certainly wouldn't want this fate to befall the solar system, even if there weren't any humans left. The dolphins and chimps still deserved their chance. I felt a pang of disappointment as visions of meeting Vulcans or Asgardians evaporated. This was more like an alien scenario. As first contact situations went, this one sucked. Like it or not, I had to bring the other Bobs into this, which brought up another problem. At this distance, I couldn't send a message back to Bill. I would need the space station for a transmission, and I would need the raw materials in order to build one. The ore contained in the Hulk, even adding in the Hulk itself, wasn't enough. I would have to leave. 58. Riker, April 2171, Sol. The big day had arrived. The colony ships had been checked out end to end. They'd been inspected by the USE delegation, and they'd done a shakedown cruise to Jupiter and back. Now they were parked in low Earth orbit, waiting for their occupants. Homer was doing a kind of war dance around my captain's chair, and I was forcibly reminded of my lack of rhythm. The VR upgrades from Bill meant that we Bobs could interact physically instead of just talking to each other through video windows. It had its downsides. I turned my attention back to the status vids, which showed people lining up for the ground to orbit shuttles. Each shuttle could handle 500 people, packed in like rush hour commuters. I remembered my early days as a working stiff, taking the sea bus across the harbor twice a day. Hard plastic benches barely wider than one's shoulders, arranged in back-to-back rows so you spent the entire trip eye-to-eye with a total stranger. And that irritating recorded lecture, every single trip telling you how to use the life jackets. Fun times. The shuttles carried more people, and the commute to the ship would take a little longer than 15 minutes. But it would be the same prosaic, boring ride. At the end of it, the passengers would be hustled along to stasis pods, given a sedative, then hooked up and locked into a box the size of a coffin, hopefully to wake up in less than 4 years ship's time at a new home. That was the plan, anyway. 10 shuttles made a total of 40 trips to move the USE colonists to the ships. A percentage of the contents of the Svalbard vaults were loaded onto each colony ship, and the shuttles were docked in the cargo holds. Then came the inevitable ceremony. Everyone had to make a speech. You'd expect the USE bigwigs to make a speech, but why did the groups from the other side of the planet feel the need? By the time we were halfway through, I had turned off my proprioception emulation to avoid falling over, virtually asleep. I reanimated Sandbox Bob to take over the video and try to look attentive. Eventually, though, they were done. Howard, our newest Bob, was making the flight with them, acting as escort, and just between Howard and me to make sure that they behaved at the other end. I hoped that was just excessive paranoia on my part, but I'd loaded Howard's cargo hold with a few of Bill's recent inventions, just in case. The colony ships had a maximum sustained acceleration of 1G, so the trip would take slightly longer than it would have for a version 1 Bob. They would be on the road for a little over 18 years. About 6 years would pass on board, but no time at all for the colonists in their stasis pods. The ships were crewed by a couple of Riker clones and a crap ton of roamers. No need for humans to risk their DNA during the voyage. I had placed the replicant matrices in the ships as one of the final tasks, thereby giving no one time to pull anything underhanded. There had been no hacking attempts, so possibly whoever it was had given up. The third ship,
designated for the Spitz and the Faith Enclave, would be leaving in 4 months.
They would establish the first settlement on whichever planet the USE contingent didn't pick. The first settlement's job would be to establish sufficient infrastructure for future groups to be able to settle in without undue hardship. It was the price of being first. Valter was philosophical about that.
Even second price is still a magnificent gift, he said in his speech.
Three more vessels were already under construction. Between new builds and returning colony ships, we hoped to maintain a steady stream of exodus from Terra, as long as there were people who wanted to leave. Meanwhile, the resources left behind in the kudzu production would continue to feed an ever-shrinking populace for a long time to come. I just hoped we'd find more colonizable worlds before people started shooting at each other again. I found myself tearing up just a little as I watched the image in the holotank, which showed the colony ships passing the orbit of Mars. After more than a decade of work, of butting heads with, a bunch of buttheads, we had actually launched. It was an emotional moment. Even Homer was silent. Finally, with a groan, I stood up and stretched.
Back to the salt mines.
Homer grinned at me and pulled up a list.
Stuff for today.
59. Bill.
May 2172. Epsilon Eridani.
I held an air horn over my head and pressed the button. A loud blat filled the room. All conversation ceased as every head turned towards me. Hey everyone, welcome to the first Bob Moot. I've built a matrix here at the Skunk Works that is more than big enough to handle everyone in the Bobiverse in VR.
Bobiverse? Really?
Garfield gave me the stink eye.
I laughed. Just thought of it. I think it's pretty good, actually.
Bobiverse. Bobnet. This galaxy may not be big enough for our ego. Garfield tried his best to look disapproving, but it's hard to fool yourselves. I looked around at my audience. Not a huge crowd at this point.
I had Riker, Homer, and the other clones from Sol, Bart and his clones in Alpha Centauri, and the Bobs on the way to Omicron Squared Eridani with the colonists.
That last group would be out of touch in another month or so when their tau got too high for VR interfacing. Hopefully by then, a few other Bobs would have picked up the scut plans and linked in. Homer cupped his hands around his mouth and gave me a loud boo. I looked around the group. Okay, guys, I'm hoping we can make this a regular thing. It helps to keep everyone up to date.
Plus, it'll give you an excuse to inflict baseball on us, Bart yelled.
I plead the fifth. I smiled at everyone.
Meanwhile, we have beer and coffee and a pub to sit in. Shall we?
We all popped over to the pub VR and settled into chairs. Time to celebrate.
60. Khan, April 2185.
82 Eridani.
Do not engage an enemy more powerful than you. And if it is unavoidable and you do have to engage, then make sure you engage it on your terms, not on your enemy's terms. Sun Tzu, Art of War.
We slowed down to sub-relativistic speeds well short of 82 Eridani.
We wanted plenty of time to scope out the situation without alerting Medeiros to our presence. Bill had made good on his promise to avenge Milo. 8 version 3 Bobs, including myself, were poised outside the system, just itching to give Medeiros a piece of our collective mind. But Medeiros had had 35 years now to establish himself.
None of us thought we'd be able to simply waltz in and whoop his butt like back at Epsilon Eridani or Alpha Centauri.
And because we have always been a cautious person, reconnaissance was going to be a major priority. We had 2 scout probes each, with heavily shielded reactors, 3 light-hour range SUDARs, and SCUD communications. And booby traps. We didn't want Medeiros getting hold of any of that tech. And we had a new weapon in reserve, courtesy of Bill's Skunk Works. We deliberately came in from Stellar North at right angles to the plane of the ecliptic. While we didn't expect Medeiros to be a two-dimensional thinker, he was, after all, military, we did expect his assets to be mostly along the ecliptic. Our probes should be able to fall through that plane before he could react.
We launched the scouts across a broad front to get the best overall scan of the system. With no radio emissions and a heavily shielded reactor, there was a good chance most of them would go right through undetected. However, there was no way we were going to get away clean. Our hope was that if Medeiros detected only one or two probes, he would conclude that there was only one Bob out here. I sent out a meeting invitation to the rest of the squad. Within milliseconds, seven Bobs popped into my VR. I looked around the table. Strategy session, boys. Hannibal accepted a coffee from Jeeves as he popped up a system schematic. We will watch for anything hiding behind moons or planets, not falling for that trick twice. We've got a good idea of where things are, thanks to Milo's preliminary report. Will, abruptly, Hannibal disappeared from the VR. We looked at each other in shock, then as one we abandoned our VRs and went into Framejack. Who's physically closest to Hannibal? I posed the question in reflex, although I was already checking our deployment diagram. Hannibal was at the end of the line of Bobs, with Tom next to him. Tom, got a SADR reading? Tom's response came back after a millisecond. I have a very diffuse SADR reading, but no Hannibal. Hold on. We waited for an eternal 4 milliseconds for Tom to continue. The diffuse area is spreading and thinning. I'm guessing an explosion of some kind. Everyone might want to do a full sweep and hang the surprise factor. I decided that was a good idea, and I cranked my SADR up to full power, going for a 3 light-hour full spherical ping. The response was negative, except for a vagueness, like a shadow seen out of the corner of your eye in the direction of the system. I refocused and sent a tight beam ping in that direction. Pay dirt. Something is headed our way, guys, at very high speed, and it's cloaked or shielded or something, to the point that I could only see it when I was pinging straight at it. Grunts from a few of the others acknowledged the information. I've got 1-2, Barney reported. Same from Tom. It took a few milliseconds to compare notes, and we realized that 3 unidentified objects were heading our way and still accelerating. We launched 3 of our regular probes directly at them to try to get a visual. They're dodging, Fred said. I think they're expecting the probe to try to ram. Well, not a bad idea if we can manage it, I responded. But first we want telemetry. It took a little over 15 minutes at the combined velocities of the probes and the approaching objects for them to pass each other. The incoming bogey was still dodging back and forth. The probes were only able to get a frame or two of poor images as they passed by, but they managed full SADR scans. As the results popped up over our desks, courtesy of Scott Instantaneous Communications, there were gasps. Nuclear freaking bombs. He's built fission weapons. With shielded reactors and very, very large surge drives, Fred added. That jives with the readings I've been getting. I think Hannibal is just a radioactive cloud now, Tom said. We are screwed. My ass, I retorted. How long do we have until they're close enough to be able to take us out? Tom, do you have a feel for the megatonnage? There was a moment of silence before Tom popped up a sensor readout in our VRs. Because we were still in Framejack, it wasn't even paper, just a raw window with a data listing. Here's the min-max analysis. We've got 4 minutes, an eternity. No chance to dodge, given their speed and spread. We don't have time to get outside the blast radii. So, Kyle said, Medeiros seems to have set this up well. He probably thinks he's outflanked us, but good. I smiled at Kyle's dry delivery. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's melt them down. 2 Bobs per bomb, and I'll add a follow-up shot if needed. Everyone acknowledge when charged. We were about to roll out our secret weapon. Bill had taken the lightsaber tech, which was essentially a high-temperature ionized plasma in a magnetic bottle, and used it to build something new. He found a way to project the plasma and the magnetic field within it, like a torpedo. The result was a 1,000,000-degree highly charged spear that splashed against whatever it ran into and generally melted right through it, while delivering a very localized EMP.
The weapon had been tested extensively at Epsilon Eridani, but this would be the first real-world use.
When everyone indicated a full charge, I said, Fire. 6 plasma spikes shot out at close to light speed. One of the biggest advantages to this weapon was that it was invisible to SADR since there was very little actual mass involved, and any other form of detection was limited by light speed. The plasma spikes couldn't follow a dodging target, but the target wouldn't know they were coming until they arrived. It took only moments for the spikes to cross the distance, and all three shadows disappeared. Full-on Sudar pings at the narrowest and most intense setting detected nothing but small, fragmentary blips. Ned spoke for all of us.
Well, that was unsettling.
Fred added, we were barely able to detect those things at all, and even that only because of Bill's Sudar improvements. Did Medeiros invent some kind of Sudar cloaking? I doubt it, I answered. He never struck us as anything but career military. I think it's more likely that the Brazilian Empire had this tech developed back on Earth. They may have uploaded all their top-secret military tech to him before sending him out. That would explain the nukes, too. So this might not be the last surprise. A round of curses and grunts answered that statement. There was silence for a few moments before Ned spoke up again.
I guess we need to have another strategy session.
Cloaking? Bill's face was a study in surprised interest. Yep, that's the only explanation we can come up with. I replayed the entire sequence for him in a window, including pop-ups of the sensor readings of the bombs.
Well, crap. See if you can grab a sample or something. Meanwhile, I'll work on it from this end. I guess the element of surprise is gone, though.
Bill gave me an informal salute and disappeared. Great. Eight of us. No, seven now. Against an unknown number and disposition of Madeiri. I did not like the odds. Meeting, I called out. Six other bobs popped into my VR. Bill didn't have much for us. He pointed out quite correctly that if we leave now with the intention of coming back, Medeiros will be even more prepared for us. He suggests we get our backups up to date and dive in.
Easy for him to say.
That was from Elmer, who had never been particularly enthusiastic about this venture. I think maybe quantum differences had left him a little light in the spine department. I was reminded of Bill Paxton's character in Aliens. I glared at Elmer for a second, then continued. We have the plasma spikes, and we have the busters. With the new controlled fusion detonation, it's not a lot. Best we can do, I think, is raise some hell before he takes us out. Make sure your dead mans are in order. Do a differential and kiss your asses goodbye. We're going in. With that, the bobs disappeared from my VR. Seven ships turned toward the center of the system, and we began to accelerate in at 10G. The first part of our dive into the inner system was relatively easy. Medeiros was still working on the assumption that we all had the same Sudar and that he could see anything we launched at him. By the time we'd destroyed a half dozen of his flying bombs, I guess he finally got the memo. Sudar area pings showed everything with a surge drive scattering in all directions. At the same time, over 100 fusion sources lit up the area and started to move. Decoys, I guess. Effective, too. We had no way to know which ones were real targets. Meeting. As soon as the other bobs showed up, I started. Okay, some of these fusion sources are decoys, probably most. But some will be Madeiri, and some will be weapons, and there will be cloaked bombs as well. Suggestions? Elmer spoke up first, which surprised me.
The bombs need to be within a certain distance to do any harm. If we move as a unit and assign certain bobs to watching for the cloaked devices, we should be able to prevent any from getting too close.
And, Fred cut in, if we destroy any decoys that get within that range as well, we might be okay. Certainly better than splitting up, I conceded. But the plasma spikes are only useful until Medeiros figures it out and starts jinking around. Plus, recharging the spike cannons takes time. They aren't like Hollywood six-shooters.
Then we need to do as much damage as possible before he figures it out, Tom said decisively.
Let's just start blasting. Maybe no plan will throw him off a bit. That was just stupid enough to be brilliant. We looked at each other wordlessly, nodded, and got to work. It became a game of cat and mouse. Medeiros knew that we had something that could destroy his units without warning. He may have thought it was a cloaked missile. He reacted by scattering his units and using the decoys to distract us. We destroyed many units, but had no idea if we were destroying anything useful. Finally came the moment we'd been dreading. One of Medeiros's units dodged several plasma spikes and managed to get within detonation range. Barely.
The resulting EMP and blast of radiation played hell with internal systems for a few moments. Fortunately, the version 3 heavens had multiple redundancies. 5 of us were able to continue. The other 2 must have lost too much functionality. Their dead man's activated and they disappeared in reactor overload. I hoped Fred and Jackson's backups were recent and complete. But Medeiros must have twigged to the fact that our weapon didn't chase its target. In the time that it took him to send out commands at light speed, every Medeiros-controlled unit in the system was bearing down on us, jinking like crazy. Plan B, guys, split up and do as much damage as possible. We headed off in random directions, jinking as well. While we ran, I did an analysis from the recorded telemetry of Medeiros' change in tactics. His units were given orders via radio. The ones closest to Medeiros would have started the new tactic first, followed by units farther away as the signal spread from the center. The center, of course, was Medeiros. It took about 40 milliseconds to determine where he must be to within a few thousand kilometers. That was too large an area for random plasma spike shots, but not too large for intelligent busters on a mission. I transmitted the coordinates to the other Bobs, and we simultaneously launched every buster we had. At the same time, we all activated SUDAR jamming at maximum intensity. Everyone in the system was now blind, except for traditional visual and radar. The trick would be to keep it going until Hector and Tom's SCUT signals cut off without warning. I felt a pang of sorrow. They'd almost certainly been caught by a nuke. That left 3 of us, plus whatever busters were still going. I kept spiking fusion sources as best I could. The AMI pilots tended to be a little predictable. Many of them settled into a pattern of dodges that I could predict after several iterations. Then Barney dropped out.
That left just Elmer and me.
I had to give him credit. Now that things had hit the fan, he was no longer whining about the danger.
I mentally upgraded him to Michael Biehn.
2 nukes went off around me almost at the same time. They must have been a little impatient or saw their solution deteriorating, because the distance was a little too great for annihilation. Not too great for damage, though. I was dead in the water for several minutes while Guppy scrambled the roamers to replace or reroute systems. You okay, Con? It was Elmer checking up on me. A little damage. Roamers are on it. Don't try to cover me. We don't want to present a single target. No problem, dude. Having some fun of my own over here.
Surge drive online.
That's what I wanted to hear. I jammed the gas pedal all the way down to emergency level and shot away at 15G. I wasn't able to keep that up for long, but it saved my bacon as another nuke went off behind me just out of range. Finally, when I had just about decided I'd had enough excitement for the century, the busters converged on the point in space where we believed Medeiros to be. Remote telemetry showed 44 busters bearing down on 3 Brazilian probes. The Medeiri must have finally gotten a visual warning because they turned and scattered, but it was far too late. At least half of the busters made contact of some kind before there wasn't anything left that was big enough to register as a target. Just one small problem. Destroying Medeiros didn't deactivate his units. We were still being chased by dozens of fusion signatures, at least some of which were real threats. Got any ideas, Elmer? How's your equipment, Con? Well, I'm going to need new underwear, but I'm still running. I'm not so good. My surge has gone intermittent, and I don't have time or parts to fix it. Elmer was silent for a moment, and sympathy and sadness washed over me. He was screwed, and we both knew it. I've uploaded a differential to Bill, so to quote the Celine Dion song, oh, please don't, Elmer. He laughed. Gotcha. So you turn off your SUDAR jamming and run silent out of here. I'll keep blinding everyone until the last moment. Give Bill my regards. Will do, buddy. Sayonara. Hasta la vista, baby. I did as he said. Once my SUDAR emitter went silent, the Brazilian units locked onto the only bright source of SUDAR in the area. As I ran from the area, Elmer's relayed telemetry showed close to 50 units converging. Then he was gone.
I coasted for 2 weeks to get far enough away from 82 Eridani before I reactivated all systems.
I had given a full report to Bill, and I spent the time doing more thorough repairs. The last thing I needed was equipment failure halfway between stars.
Of the 8 Bobs that went to 82 Eridani, I was the only one left.
I think we took the Madeira out, so I guess it was a success from that point of view, but I couldn't convince myself that the whoopin' had all been one way. I popped into Bill's VR. Hey, Bill.
Hi, Con.
Bill gave a flash of a smile. I still can't say that without wanting to yell it. We shared the standard laugh. Good names were getting a little scarce, and I was glad to have picked one that had some nerd lore behind it. Did we get all the backups? Bill shook his head, looking unhappy. Three didn't complete. Scut bandwidth just isn't dependable enough. Lots of dropped packets and resends. I've added them to the in memoriam list. Elmer? Bill smiled. A small, sad smile.
He made it.
Guess he surprised all of us, right? I nodded and let the silence extend for a few milliseconds. We're going to have to go back, you know. Bill nodded.
We don't know for sure that we got all the Madeira, even if we got all the active ones. And those AMI units will still be wandering around looking for things to blow up.
Bill waved a hand.
And, not to put too fine a point on it, I have to find out how he's doing that cloaking. That's a real danger to us.
I rubbed my chin in thought for a second, then looked at my hand in amusement. We Bobs were so used to VR now that we felt fully human most of the time. But once in a while, the incongruousness of an action would jerk one of us back to reality. Bill, I want to be in on the next wave. I owe that to the guys we lost. It will take me 13 years to get back, so load my backup into one of the new ships. I'll send you a full, and let me know if it comes through. Okay?
Bill nodded.
I gave him a salute and disappeared from his VR. Medeiros, I'm coming back for you.
61. Howard, September 2188.
Omicron Squared, Eridani.
We'd arrived. I can't even begin to describe the feelings of joy and relief as I passed the Kuiper Belt and officially entered the Omicron Squared Eridani system.
No Vulcan cruisers flew up to intercept us, so I added a few to my VR, just because. I did a quick scan of the systems to confirm Milo's survey results and verify our orientation to the ecliptic plane. The two colony ships, Bert and Ernie, yeah, they named themselves that, yes, voluntarily, came into the system at a much more sedate 1G deceleration. They would arrive at Vulcan and Romulus a week or two behind me. I'd been thinking off and on about what it would be like to be a colony ship. The guys would be essentially running a shuttle service for up to a couple of centuries. Fly to Earth, fly to Vulcan, fly to Earth, fly somewhere else, rinse, repeat. On the other hand, they were doing a very valuable service for humanity. Any Bob could appreciate that. And with our arrival, humanity now officially no longer had all its eggs in one basket. Now perhaps we could start to think about breathing a little easier. But just a little. I dropped into the L4 point between Vulcan and Romulus and dropped a beacon. We would set up there to do initial recon and to give Colonel Butterworth and his people a chance to make a decision. Since I had 10 days or so to kill, I sent some exploration drones to each planet to expand on Milo's survey information. Then I settled back with a cup of coffee to relax. Milo had left a couple of AMIs and a bunch of auto-factory drones behind to continue mining the system. The drones put the refined metals into bundles of ingots and set beacons on them. With a couple of decades of peace and quiet, the automation had accumulated several hundred thousand tons of ready-to-use material, all in orbit, inside the asteroid belt. Riker had started the AMI on building a farming donut a decade ago, to provide a backup food source. It would need only to be seeded from the stocks we'd brought with us. I hoped we wouldn't need it. Of course, I didn't hope that anything like as strongly as the colonists would. Kudzu was apparently not the food of the gods, although deities were often invoked when describing it. I had quick conversations with Bill and Riker just to let them know we'd made it. Full reports would follow. Riker gave me a list of colony ships that were already launched and on their way. But no pressure, right? Exodus 1 and Exodus 2 settled into orbit without a hitch. We had a brief flurry of scut exchanges, then Bert and Ernie shut down the drives and went to station keeping. Welcome to the home of Spock, boys. I popped into the common VR and grinned at them. They were grinning back, of course. After all, Bob,
Bert and Ernie had adopted Battlestar Galactica-style uniforms and command deck VRs. I was a little surprised by that, as it hadn't been one of my favorite shows. Although the Cylons were definitely badass. I was seriously considering putting up a couple of Vulcan cruisers to escort us in, Ernie said. I felt my face turn red, and Bert started laughing so hard he almost lost his seat. We took a minute to enjoy the joke. Belly laughs are one of the best things about being sentient, and you should never miss a chance for one. We wiped the tears from our eyes, and I pulled up a holo of the system, with Vulcan and Romulus showing in an inset window. We'll want to push Butterworth to make a decision as quickly as possible. I want the colonists offloaded at the earliest possible date, and you guys on your way back to Earth. I gestured toward the holo. Butterworth already has Milo's survey results, and I've been adding to the data. This isn't going to be a negotiation. He picks A or B, and we move. Ernie nodded. Guppy advises me that Butterworth has come out of stasis, and he'll be ready to talk within an hour. I'll package it up for him, let him have some quiet time to study it. Meeting in, say, 3 hours? Bert and I nodded, and we moved on to the next item.
There really was never much doubt, Colonel Butterworth said with a smile. The video showed him sitting in the Exodus One's common room. Barring significant new information coming up at this end, Vulcan makes much more sense. We will need time to establish our own food production, so a robust ecosystem will bridge that gap for us.
He nodded to the camera.
Thank you for confirming biocompatibility of the local ecosystem. It settles a lot of uncertainties.
I smiled in acknowledgement. Colonel Butterworth had become much more relaxed now that his civilian population seemed to have a future. He continued, in a distracted voice.
We'll hopefully be in a position to help out the Spitz when they show up, until they have their food production set up.
He arched an eyebrow at me.
Farm One won't be producing yet, right?
Not yet, Colonel. But since most of the colonists will stay in stasis until we're ready for them, ship's stores will be sufficient for the first month. Colonel Butterworth grunted.
Still tighter than I like.
The Colonel stared, rapt, at the virtual bulletin board that Bert had provided. The board showed real-time status of all current, upcoming, and completed colony setup activities. Video windows showed a constant rotation of views. Setup crews were awake and had begun shuttling printers down to Vulcan. On the surface, roamers were printing out modular residential units and assembling them. AMI-controlled bobcats and backhoes stayed just ahead of the construction, preparing the ground for the houses. In 2 days, we would start waking the first wave of civilians and shuttling them down to their new homes. And the universe would have actual Vulcans. Roddenberry would be proud.
This has been an Audible Studios production of We Are Legion, We Are Bob, Bobiverse Book 1. Written by Dennis E. Taylor. Performed by Ray Porter. Producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 2016 Dennis E. Taylor. Production copyright 2016 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.